Here I am. Well, all that anger out there. A lot of people simply determined to stick their heads into the oily sand. I've got a guest. He's the chief executive officer of the National Wildlife Federation, and his name is Larry Schweiger. And so we're going to continue with this and find out as much as we can. Certainly, this is a man who has looked deeply into the problem. Nobody knows all the answers. In fact, there's a lot going on, a lot of rumors and so forth, as always, on the internet. We'll touch on a few of those and ask Larry about them. He may not know the answers. I don't think any of us knows, would know all the answers, but we'll take a stab at it anyway. For example, I'm getting a lot of messages asking about fractures under the sea. There's a lot of internet babble going on about fractures under the sea. Certainly, I hope that's not true, but that's one of the big rumors making the rounds right now. This is, without a doubt, the worst United States accident of its sort by many, many magnitudes. As oil continues to gush into the Gulf, will there be dead areas in the Gulf? Are there already dead areas in the Gulf? I imagine scientists are probing that issue and many others. We'll be right back. All right. Once again, Larry Schweiger. Welcome back, Larry.
Thank you.
You know, it's hard to know where to go, but let me ask you about some of the things running around the internet right now. A lot of people are blogging about fractures. This is beyond, you know, the well itself, the wellhead itself. Fractures in the floor of the Gulf that are spewing oil. Is there? Have you heard anything about that? Is there anything to it?
Well, there's always a certain amount of natural oil that seeps into not just the Gulf, but into other locations around the world. There are some natural seeps. The other thing I would point out is the place where this well was drilled and in the deeper waters, what we have is quite a number of methane formations. The methane that leaks from the subsurface makes its way to the water itself, and because it's under such pressure and it's also cold temperatures, the methane freezes and forms a crystalline structure that they call the hydrites. And there are vast hydrites under the ocean scattered throughout the world, and in fact they become probably the largest store of carbon under the sea. And so when they're drilling through these hydrites, they're really running headlong right into large quantities of methane, both at the well site as well as adjacent to it in the various methane formations.
The hydrites are what jammed up the effort, the initial effort to for Top Kill and all the rest of it, right?
Yeah, that's right, and that's part of the challenge is because they're at such incredible pressures and low temperatures, it has a tendency to freeze up the methane. It's at a pressure temperature range that the methane turns into crystalline. People heard about the ice and they think about water turning to ice, but this is actually the methane. And of course, it was the methane that caused the explosion in the first place. So we're adding a lot of methane to the water column as well as oil. And the methane helps to suck the oxygen out of the water. And when you talk about dead zones, you're really talking about the biological oxygen demand of oil dispersed into the water and also the so-called BOD of the methane as it consumes oxygen. And the warmer the waters get, the more biological activity there is working on the more the bugs in the ocean begin to work on the oil. The more they suck the oxygen out of the water, and therefore cause and then creates this potential having enormous dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico.
Oh God! All right. Our federal government, the president's kind of between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, this becomes a little political, but if the president touches this disaster, then, as the talking heads suggest, he owns it. After a while, he owns it. And I guess by now, he sort of owns it politically. And the president's approval numbers are tumbling right now as a result of owning this. But I think he had no choice as president of the United States. How is the federal government doing now in terms of their role in trying to help the impact, the cleanup, working with BP, all the rest of it?
Well, you know, there's this historic relationship between the Coast Guard and the oil companies. And frankly, folks have been concerned about that. You know, the Coast Guard started off by calling BP its partner and sharing websites and, you know, sharing a command center with BP and all that sort of thing. And so there was a relationship there that I should say built up over many years that was entirely too cozy and not at arm's length. The same thing is true with the Minerals Management Service. There was the same sort of cozy relationship, and you know, they were, in fact, there's a lot of revolving door people who formerly worked for the oil industry working for the government and so forth. You know, I don't think that was healthy. It was not the result of this administration. It was more a result of many years of relationships that were built up. And as a result, we did not have, I don't think, in place an aggressive review of these permits before they're issued. In fact, the plans that were submitted had included protection for walruses in the Gulf of Mexico. And
I heard that.
It's that shows you how anemic and really pathetic the planning was, and we saw that when we got down there. It's a little bit like trying to organize a fire department after your house is on fire. BP had a rig burn up and had all this oil spewing into the ocean, and began to, you know, several weeks after the spill had been in full bloom, had begun to try to organize fishermen to, you know, to set up booms and to do other things. And these folks were not trained in hazmat handling. They were not properly equipped. They were not trained to dispatch booms and the other things that they're required to do now. And I think that's another example of the failures that occurred here. But clearly there were a lot of problems. On the positive side, I think what the president did a few days ago in establishing this $20 billion open-ended fund, he did something that did not happen in the Exxon spill, and something that was very, very important. You know, after the Exxon spill, the fishermen, the communities that were harmed, had to go to court to fight Exxon to get some compensation, and they ended up getting a $5 billion settlement from a jury. And by the time that worked its way all the way through to the Supreme Court, because Exxon appealed it with their many lawyers, they ended up getting about 7 to 12 cents on a dollar and a $500 million settlement. Over 20% of the people who were harmed never got a dime before they died. And so that was justice delayed, and it never really ended up being just, because they didn't get what they deserved in terms of a settlement. And so by the president establishing this $20 billion fund, I think he has protected the people in the Gulf from this kind of long and drawn out legal battle to try to get recovery. And, you know, so I think that was a very, very important moment. And we hope certainly that some of that money will also be made available to help restore the damaged wetlands.
I hope so. In a way, we're lucky that it was BP that had this spill, because they've got the financial muscle, I hope, without going belly up, to get us through to the other end, whatever the other end of this is going to be. They're a large company, and they're really taking a lot of terrible hits, and probably deservedly so, for what we're hearing were the mistakes, misjudgments, things that went wrong with equipment, all the human error, all the rest of it. They're probably taking all the deserved hits, but it is pretty rough, and it's a good thing it's BP, because they do have the money to do this, and that's about as much as I can say that's positive for BP right now, as much as I can muster up. So you're directly involved, I suppose, in efforts to help clean up, you know, the wildlife that are being impacted, all the oiled birds and all the... Is this the end of our seafood supply from the Gulf, or is that an overreach? Is that too much to say?
I think it's an overreach. First of all, I want to step back a bit. We're involved in the search part of the search and rescue. We've been dispatching groups of volunteers to identify where birds are showing up and where turtles are being oiled. And but BP is actually has other groups under contract to clean up these birds and animals. And so we have decided not to take any money from BP and to stay out of that part of it. But to get back to your question, the issue we have is that there are certain places where oil will have enormous impact on the fish and shellfish. oysters, for example, can magnify the concentration of oil by a factor of 1,000. So if you have one part per million oil in the water, oysters can magnify that to 1,000 parts per million. So it will take a long time to get the oil concentrations down to the point where you won't be able to you know, smell or taste or have a negative effect on your food in certain areas because of this biomagnification problem. But we expect that over time that may recover. We also would hope that there are other places in the Gulf where there are, you know, shrimp and blue crabs and that sort of thing that haven't gotten oiled. In those places, certainly it's still acceptable and safe to eat the food. And it's our hope that the federal government does a good job of monitoring. And I think to date they seem to be doing a good job of responding to oil movement and making sure that the public is not consuming contaminated fish.
Well, I guess fishing is now banned in what, about a third of the entire Gulf?
Yeah, it's a real sad story, you know, when you're down at these fishing marinas, because, you know, this is one of the real hot spots for recreational fishermen, as well as the commercial takes that I talked about earlier. And in fact, we did a telephone call with sportsmen and had over 9,000 hunters and anglers on the phone with us, because they wanted to find out what was happening to the places where they fish and where they hunt. And they're very concerned, because these are some really great places for those who enjoy fishing and hunting.
Mm-hmm. There's been obviously a lot of comparison between the BP disaster and Exxon Valdez. In orders of magnitude, what do we know right now? How much worse is this than Exxon Valdez?
Well, it depends on the numbers that you use, but you know, certainly we're at least 10 times worse today, and maybe much more because of the sheer volume of oil spilling. But it's not a straight line relationship. The oil that was dumped from the Exxon Valdez was a sour crude. This is a sweet crude. The water temperatures in the Prince William Sound were lower, and it was a one-time event. When the Exxon Valdez struck the Bly Reef, it dumped its load fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, here we have this you know, day in and day out pouring of you know, large quantities of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. So there are other factors that are at play here, and it's also being spewed at 1 mile down, as opposed to being spilt on the surface. So, you know, there are you know, differences, and but this spill is so much greater than that. It's hard to even make the comparison.
Compare. Hmm. If you take a middle figure, in terms of the estimates of how much oil is going into the Gulf, What do you think it is right now? Do you have a sort of a best guess?
Well, I've sort of looked to the experts on the numbers, and we've been upset because from the beginning, because BP has been saying it doesn't matter, when in fact it does matter. You know, it has to do with their ability to deal with the total oil spill, but it also has to do with their liabilities. You know, for every gallon of oil that's put into the Gulf, they are liable under the Clean Water Act for the pollution that they're causing.
And when they say it doesn't matter, Larry, what do they mean?
Well,
it doesn't matter.
You know, early on, they kept saying, well, it doesn't matter. We're just trying to get it shut off and, you know, and trying to, you know, really discourage people from speculating on how much oil. And we've seen a number of estimates, and you know, I think we're still waiting for the official, you know, firm numbers from the federal government. And I think we ought to demand that the federal government put a hard number on this, because in fact that will ultimately determine how much they're liable for in terms of the Clean Water Act penalties. And it also matters a great deal, because when we start trying to figure out how much oil is still out there and what it may do to Florida, what it may do to the Gulf Stream, and what it may do to others, it matters greatly. I think.
Well, I've heard estimates. I mean, BP at first said, what, 1,000 barrels a day or something of that nature, I believe. And then I began hearing 5,000, 10,000. 20, 30, 40, 50,000, some up to 100,000 barrels a day.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is important, not just in terms of their liability, but in terms of understanding the magnitude of what we're facing.
Exactly. And that's been part of the game all along, is to hide the ball with dispersants and to try to, you know, undersize the total scale of the spill in a way that the it really misses the mark. And we've seen it. CNN, for example, has clips of various people making spill estimates, and it's really quite humorous when you see them all together strung in, you know, in a continuous set of projections. It's really laughable, and that's why I hate to get into the game until the scientists who are doing the assessments actually, you know, put a firm number on it. But you're absolutely right that the numbers have ranged from being completely undersized to perhaps you know, being close to the mark with 100,000 a day.
Now, just working with round numbers, 100,000 barrels of oil, a lot of Americans don't relate to that, but they do relate to gallons. Everybody knows what a gallon of gas is. So if you had 100,000 barrels of oil, how many millions of gallons would that be?
Well, for every barrel of oil, you're talking about 42 gallons of oil. So, you know, just do the math and you get this, you know, this astronomical number of gallons of oil that are being, you know, spewed into the Gulf each and every day.
God. So that could be... well, who knows? But 20, 30, 40 million gallons of oil. Is that right?
Yeah, it's hard to say, and I don't want to, you know, call a number, but you know, I think clearly, you know, we're seeing extraordinarily high numbers of oil, gallons of oil flowing into the Gulf. And you know, we should also remember that this oil was destined to be burnt. And if it were, it would be carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere. It would be invisible, but it nonetheless would be put into the sky.
All right, Larry, I'm sorry. We're at another break. Stay right there, and we'll be right back from Manila, Philippines, other side of the world. I'm Art Bell. Good morning from the other side of the world. How are you? My guest is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Wildlife Federation, Larry Schweiger. We're talking about, of course, the oil spill, and I'm going to venture out on a limb here a little bit. And I've been wondering about this for a long time, and people are seem afraid to talk about it, but I want to ask the question anyway. And I'll give Larry a moment to think about it. BP has made some statements, made them early on, that one final thing that they might do is implode the well. Now, it seems to me if they were going to do that, it would have been best done some long time ago, before we had so much oil going to the Gulf. But is it possible? That's one question I have. And how do you implode a well? Well, it's my understanding that the Soviets, many years ago, used small nuclear devices to implode two or three wells that had the same sort of problem. Now, I'm not necessarily recommending the use of a nuclear weapon there. However, I'm not excluding it either. And it may be possible that it could be done with conventional explosives as well. So I do wonder why they have not attempted it. There may be a technical reason and a risk that I don't properly understand, but certainly a nuclear weapon, a small nuclear weapon, or a large amount of conventional explosives would have a chance of collapsing. There is, after all, a couple thousand feet or better of rock between where the oil is coming from and where, and its exit point. So if it would be possible to turn that into essentially glass, it's a metaphor really, and stop the oil, then I would first wonder why it wasn't done some time ago and whether it is possible that it would be done now. And another question I have, Larry, and I know you're listening, is that these relief wells that are being drilled, how much of a chance is there that these relief wells really are going to cure the problem, that they're going to be able to cement it up, do whatever they have to do once they get to the proper depth sometime in August? That's still quite a ways away. So a couple of questions, one involving the use of explosives to seal the well instead of allowing this to continue, what the risks are versus the possible benefit. And, you know, the moment you say the word nuclear, everybody cringes, and I include me in that group. However, if it would stop the ongoing disaster, then why not? And I have heard a couple of sort of quiet voices in the night advocating such a thing. I would just like to understand. I'm sure at high levels it has been discussed, not publicly for the most part, but discussed. If we could stop it, would that not be a proper and peaceful use of nuclear energy? So there you are. I want to ask the question. Larry will be back along with myself in a moment. Once again, Larry Schweiger. Larry, welcome back. I guess people are just really hesitant to talk about this sort of thing, but I do understand that it's been done, that wells can be imploded. They can be sealed in that way with explosives, nuclear or otherwise. And do you know if there have been high-level talks about this? I mean, certainly there have been. Are you privy to what the risks are of doing something like that to stop the flow?
Well, you know, the question of high-level discussions, the Energy Department made it clear that they are not at all considering the idea of a nuclear device. Steve Chu, who happens to be the head of the department, has been asked about that, and they have repeatedly said that there's no way that would be done. In fact, they would also suggest...
Larry, if you don't mind, is that a political or a scientific decision?
I think it starts with a scientific decision. The idea of, first of all, the Russians do things that a little bit more on the edge than we have. They've disposed old nuclear subs under the ocean. They've thrown canisters into the deep sea, things that we would never even consider. And someday we'll come back to, frankly, haunt the people who live nearby. And I think we learned with Chernobyl that they were using technology that had much higher risk than anything we would ever do. So I wouldn't compare what Russians do with what we should do. The other thing that I would point out is that that it would be a violation of international treaties to do such a thing. And beyond that, though, you know, the idea of setting off a nuclear bomb in the clathrates because of all this methane that is under the sea, I think
that's a good point.
Would be another very, very dangerous thing. So, you know, that is an option that's clearly off the table from the Energy Department and from the others involved. I think the effort to intercept this well with secondary wells is the greatest hope that we have. And so we can, you know, expect in the next several weeks, maybe 2 months, to get to the point where they can do a bottom kill on this well. And you know, the chances of that working are not great, but they're certainly a lot better than what we've seen to date.
Okay, well, that's exactly how you say not great. The chances of the relief wells not working, not great, really? I thought it was almost a done deal that when they got down there with relief wells, they could stop it. And you're saying not good, chances not good?
Well, I would say that you know, that there's a certain amount of chance in terms of hitting the right spot, in terms of you know, getting there on the first try. You know every time they try, they're going to get, you know, get a better shot at it. But you know, the idea that you're going to drill one well and kill it on the first try, I would say that the chances of that are not great. The chances over the next several weeks to months after that we might get something to work, I think, increase with additional steps. But, you know, I would hate to have us all hang our hopes on a single effort and expect that it would stop as soon as that relief well was completed. But
all right, before we leave the idea of implosion completely, all right, so they're not going to use a nuclear device, even though the Russians did successfully do so in two or three cases. What about conventional explosives? Same problem with methane?
Well, again, I think, you know, the idea of using explosives is really throwing the dice. You know, you're basically doing something that is not easily controlled, and you know, you're really taking there's a risk consequence equation that would have to come into play, and I just don't think that's a good approach. The trick here, I think, is to find a conventional way to intercept the leaking oil and to, you know, eventually shut it off, and to contain this well once and for all through perhaps through one of the bottom kill methods that they're working on.
Mm-hmm. This well, apparently, just looking at the numbers, again, what BP originally said in terms of the amount of oil coming and the reality of how much oil is coming, also bears on the pressures involved. In other words, obviously, to be having the kind of numbers at the top end of what people are talking about, 100,000 barrels, is an enormous amount of pressure. And that may, I guess that's what fouled the top kill efforts. There simply was too much pressure and too much ice, hydrides and so forth. So there must be an incredible amount of pressure, much more than anybody thought or talked about, coming from underground, pushing all this up. And will that bear on the possible success or failure possibility of the relief wells, just the amount of pressure involved?
Well, first of all, coming back to the pressure point in the previous comment about the explosives, you know, one of the things about exploding a device of any sort down there is that, in fact, you may be creating more fractures and creating at some point an uncontrollable leak situation. So that's one of the criteria that has been considered in any strategy that they've looked at.
With a couple of thousand feet of rock.
Yeah, the rock structure there is is such that it is contained at this moment, but clearly any disruption could in fact fracture rock and have oil leaking from this fracture. So I think that's one of the reasons why we have to use great care down there and what's being done. The thing about all of this is that we're drilling at a depth that the U.S. government doesn't even have a vessel that can get on there and independently inspect this well site. We have to depend on equipment that BP provides for us, and if it weren't for example Congressman Markey, we would not even be seeing the spill itself, because BP was not allowing the public to see the wellhead, even though they had film footage of that from the very beginning. So we're really at a depth where humans can't go, and where we don't even have a vessel to get down to that level to see what's actually taking place down there.
Including our nuclear submarines?
Including our submarines. So we're down over a mile in the water, and the U.S. Fleet does not have a device that can get down that far.
Okay. There's a six-month moratorium now on drilling in the Gulf. And certainly a court fight going on right now about it. Do you support that moratorium, or how do you feel about it at this point? I know it's really magnifying the disaster for the people who are in the industry and the jobs that are lost and all the rest of it. So, where do you stand on the moratorium?
Well, we supported the president's call for a moratorium until we could understand what we're doing here. There's been a lot of applications. In fact, there are applications pending right now for wells almost twice the depth of the current well. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to us to go back to deep water drilling until we understand what we did wrong here. It would be like a particular aircraft having a mechanical that causes it to crash, and then to, allow other planes to take off without knowing what caused the first plane to crash. I mean, we've suspended operations in the past in other areas, and it's a prudent thing to do. When a brakes fail on a car, and a particular model shows a pattern of brake failure, you pull the plug and you take a step back and figure out what's going on. And I think that's what the president is calling for, is a pause in the drilling. And I should also point out that part of the settlement with BP was to, in fact, pay the salaries of those who were displaced temporarily while this assessment was being completed. So the idea of us going back with additional drilling rigs and potentially repeating this mistake in other places, it's a high risk, and we know now the consequences are staggering. So, for a long time, the oil industry was basically saying that there was no risk of this deep water. In fact, they're spending millions of dollars on television with these ads that say the deeper you look, the better we look, and all that sort of thing. And, they were telling us that they could do all this without any damage to the ocean. And that's just turning out to be, a lot of PR. And right. Not a whole lot of science.
Mm-hmm. You've been quoted as calling the current energy investments we have as subprime. What do you mean by subprime with regard to our energy investments?
Well, if you look at the history of oil development, for example, it started in my home state of Pennsylvania many, many years ago with Drake's Well. And we have progressed over the years from a land-based energy system to for a long time the oil was being drilled in the Gulf of Mexico coastline, and that's why we lost so many of the wetlands down there. And then we moved near shore, and now we're moving to offshore. We're going after oil in places where it's very dangerous. We're pursuing energy in ways that create greater and greater environmental consequence, and we're doing that because the easy cheap oil is gone. And we're now chasing oil to the ends of the earth. You know, there's an effort to go into the Chukchi and Burford Seas in the North Sea, and again, we'll be drilling in deep water in you know, really high risk cold water systems. And you know, at some point, you have to ask the question, you know, should we not be pursuing another energy pathway? And I believe that the time is now for creating a new energy economy. We're also sending $1 billion every day to buy oil out of the Middle East. And we're draining our economy while we're also funding our enemies. None of that makes any sense at all. And we could be creating literally millions of jobs for Americans by moving to a new energy system. And
so, that's right. You said the time is now. The time was a long time ago. We should have been working on serious alternative energy long ago, Larry. We didn't do that. And, you know, it's interesting, but as I look at the day-to-day discussion about the disaster down there, I'm still not hearing about a really major move to alternative energy. I'm still not hearing it. Are you?
We are not moving to a new energy strategy because we have energy policies in Washington that are built around this old energy economy. And there are 750 oil lobbyists trying to keep us from changing those policies. So, you know, there's a real all-out effort to keep us addicted to fossil fuels in Washington. And you know, the old story about money speaks and politicians listen. We will not break our addiction to foreign oil and to oil until our politicians break the addiction to oil and fossil fuel political contributions. So these two things are very deeply connected.
Well, we don't do anything in America until it's an emergency. But if we really wait until the oil is gone, or at least the easily captured oil is gone, well, wait a minute, we've already passed that, then there's going to be a very dark period for humanity. I mean, if oil essentially is gone, and we haven't developed other means, we're going to pollute the world's oceans, I suppose. And I guess we're going to keep on drilling, baby drilling, no matter what, because we have to have it. But then at some point, it's going to be just too damn late. And then I just have no idea what'll happen. The price of oil, of course, will be up through the roof. Economies will be ruined. Wars will begin. You know, it's the worst case scenario, Larry.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we've been working, you know, very hard to help Americans even understand where their oil comes from and where these dependence connections lead us. And you know, I don't know how many times we need to say it, but you know, America needs an oil change, and it needs it today. I was chuckling because John Stewart did a segment on this, and he has eight presidents all saying the same thing, threading all the way back to Richard Nixon. And you know, each one of them makes these wild promises of getting us off oil, and none of them going to be able to pull it off. And it's the reason for that is that the oil industry turns loose its fleet of lobbyists, and they have more than one lobbyist for every member of Congress. So they work hard at keeping us you know, addicted and preventing the transformational legislation that we need to move away.
All right, Larry, hold it right there. These segments just disappear like the coastline in Louisiana and several other states. My God, it's running fast. Larry Schweiger is my guest. He's the chief executive officer of the National Wildlife Federation from Manila in the Philippines, other side of the world. I'm Art Bell.